From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with America's leading theater producer, Joe Papp. He's responsible for bringing hits such as A Chorus Line and Hair to Broadway. Papp also founded the New York Shakespeare Festival and has been a strong supporter of new playwrights. Also today, baseball analyst Bill James talks about the hidden beauty of baseball statistics. William Schimmel of the Tango Project will show us the accordion is good for more than polkas. And critic at large Laurie Stone takes a look at two books about mothers and daughters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. With me is theater impresario Joe Papp. He's considered American theater's most influential producer. He's also an innovator in using the not-for-profit theater to develop Broadway hits. Production that Papp developed in this way include A Chorus Line, That Championship Season, The Pirates of Penzance, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, and For Colored Girls. Papp founded the New York Shakespeare Festival in 1954 in the basement of a Lower East Side church. It has since grown into the nation's largest theatrical institution. Papp-produced plays have launched the careers of actors like George C. Scott, Kevin Kline, Meryl Streep, Colleen Dewhurst, and James Earl Jones. He's also nurtured the talents of playwrights like David Mamet, John Gare, Wallace Shawn, David Rabe, and Elizabeth Swados. Joe Papp is in Philadelphia to receive an honorary degree from the Philadelphia College of the Arts. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
You grew up in an immigrant family. I think English was your second language. You grew up speaking Yiddish.
That's true.
How'd you get interested in Shakespeare and in theater? Let's start with Shakespeare.
Well, you know how melodic Yiddish is, really,
yes,
as a language?
Yes, I do, yeah.
And the key to Shakespeare is the melody. The ear is the key to it. But I didn't immediately go from Yiddish to Shakespeare. It's just that I had a teacher, naturally. You get the right teacher who is committed to Shakespeare and loves Shakespeare. And it was just in the junior high school. I sort of stumbled on Julius Caesar. And the word sounded so wonderful, particularly Mark Antony. And I began to memorize just the speeches.
Did you get to the theater much?
No, I didn't know the theater existed.
How'd you find out about it?
Well, later on, they took a bunch of us when I was in high school, to see John Gielgud's Hamlet. And that was the first time I went to the theater.
And you loved it?
No, I didn't. I thought he spoke in a phony fashion. I said, why couldn't he speak more naturally? You know, he had a tremolo in his voice. He's become a gorgeous actor now. But when he was young, when I was first exposed to it, the speech sounded very strange. It was British, you know. But it was very, you know, it was, oh, that this too solid flesh would melt. Now, you know, to a kid from Brooklyn and coming from where people spoke in ordinary ways, it was too high class. But I did kind of enjoy the show. But the speech to me, I felt, was too artificial. And so, I mean, later on, I became involved with that whole concept of not having artificial British speech, but having good American speech. Not the speech I had at the time, because that was good Brooklyn speech, and it would hardly be acceptable on any stage, any time. But I prefer good American actors acting Shakespeare. I think they have the proper vitality, the proper energy, and in a certain sense, with the exception of the great, great British actors, are closer to Shakespeare than a lot of the Shakespeare I've just come back from London that I've seen.
In the late 50s, you really made headlines in New York for bringing the free Shakespeare plays to Central Park, and the Parks didn't want you to do it for free.
Not the Parks. It was the Commissioner Parks, Robert Moses. The Parks didn't mind me at all. The trees were welcoming me, and the grass was very responsive. But it was the Commissioner of Parks, and it was also the Commissioner of many other things, who objected to the people trampling the grass. And a lot of people sent him bags of bird seed and grass seed and all sorts of things. But there was a great crisis there because we were about to be thrown out. And it made the headlines, you know, day after day. And we finally got to the appellate court. And the appellate court ruled that this imperious man was arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable, and suggested, they couldn't insist, that we be permitted to play there. And as a result of that, we stayed there. Because the first time we had played in Central Park, we had a truck that I brought in, a huge platform trailer truck. in which we started with, I think, Romeo and Juliet, right, and Two Gentlemen of Verona. We did three plays, and the last was Macbeth with Colleen Dewhurst. This was her first production with us. No, she had done something the year before on the Lower East Side as Kate in The Taming of the Shrew. That's when the critic for the New York Times, Brooks Atkinson, who was he's no longer a critic, he's dead now, but he was one of the great critics, saw the show, and he said this was one of the finest Shakespeare he'd seen. And it sort of started that way. But we finally ended up in the park, and there was a theater built for us.
You were doing Shakespeare, and you were doing it for free outside.
Well, the whole concept of starting.
Why did it have to be Shakespeare, and why for free? Yeah.
Well, the whole beginning. As you were giving me this introduction, you were saying he did this, and he did that, and he also... There was no also. We started with Shakespeare. I started with this notion of wanting to bring Shakespeare to the people without charge and play in the city's parks, playgrounds, deal with the Board of Education. It was to bring with the things that I loved to other people. And I felt Shakespeare was understandable. I felt he'd been taken over too much by the academics, and they were controlling him, and he was being presented in a way that would turn a lot of people off. And so I made it sort of my commitment, and I've been with this for 34 years now, to bring the Shakespeare and to develop American actors to act the works of Shakespeare with the right emotionality, the right speech, clarity, but Americans. And not in a nationalistic way, but just clear, good American speech. The way I'm speaking to you now, I consider that fair American speech. There are people that speak it much better. But without any localisms in the speech, but without removing certain accents. I mean, I've had Raul Julia play all major parts. He's a Hispanic actor, and I don't want to ruin his marvelous accent. But he's clear in his speech. You understand every word. He has a marvelous ear. And then there's James Earl Jones, also a black actor. Now he's worried about losing his negritude. He used to say to me, "I said, you're not losing your negritude at all. Just go. You just keep what you have. It's just that the clarity was important. The final consonant endings of words. And there's nobody clearer. He has one of the greatest speaking voices, and so does Raoul. Now those are two prime examples of American speech. But there are certain unpleasant sounds in American speech. You can't talk this way. And when you can't say, now is the winter of our discontent, you have to say, now is the winter. You have to say the, you can't say duh. You can if you want to, but it won't sound very good. So you don't want affected speech. You want normal, clear speech and not sloppy speech. And when I say localisms, I'm not talking about accents, because there's a Southern accent, and I've heard a beautiful Romeo and Juliet played with a Southern speech, very soft, what light through yonder window breaks. Sounds quite beautiful. But the speech was good. The enunciation was good. So I'm into that, and I'm still into that. I mean, I'm doing two plays this summer. We have a company, incidentally, a black Hispanic and Asian company that's playing in a Broadway house, which I've acquired for 5 years, and playing primarily for the student body of the city of New York, and which is predominantly black and Hispanic and some Asian now.
My guest is Joe Papp, who's a theater producer and director. You've had shows that you nurtured in a nonprofit setting, and then they moved on to Broadway. But I don't think you've ever really tried to just move your operation altogether to Broadway.
There's no way to do that.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you ever want to do that?
I couldn't do that, because there's no way to know what play is going to succeed and what is not going to succeed. Broadway is a freelance operation. It's a commercial operation. If I have something that seems to attract a lot of attention, gets good notices, and people want to see it, I have to be very careful, because some of the best plays I do never go to Broadway. Because they're too good.
Well, you know, some people have like Broadway in their blood, and no matter what they think of Broadway, they have to be on Broadway.
No.
There's a whole mythology. Or was that mythology ever in your system about Broadway?
Never, and still not. In fact, I really don't like Broadway that much, because most of it is vulgar. I mean, most of the things that are put on stage. I mean, I produce plays, and you'll find I always have one standard of work. I would do the same thing downtown at my small theaters. I have five small theaters in one building in Greenwich Village, as I would do on Broadway or in the park. There's not a double standard. I say, well, I'm going to do this in a commercial way. I don't know what that means. I mean, we either do it well or we don't do it well. As some of the themes of the plays we do are so special. Like we did recently something called The Knife, which had to do with a transsexual. a man who's married and has children and decides he wants to have an operation. He feels he's essentially a woman. Mandy Patinkin was in that, and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio was in that. And it was a gorgeous piece. Actually, I never thought it could ever make it on Broadway. It was too special. And it was too kind of intricate. Broadway requires something that's more slam bang and much more obvious and clear. Very, very subtle things don't go well on Broadway. Usually closes Saturday night in Boston, they say about those things. Anything that's ironic, they say closes. Anything that's not clearly clear and very, very, well, popular. It has certain advantages. I like the popularity of Broadway. And the reason I go to Broadway is two reasons. One is that it's important for us. We have to make money because we give a lot of things away for nothing. We play free in the park, and that's $2.5 million. We charge very little admission. So we constantly have to finance our operation. And we need to have successes from time to time. That's one reason. The other reason, and it's closely allied, is you do reach a large popular audience on Broadway. In small theaters, you reach 200, 300 people a night. And that's fine. But I say, I'd like to reach lots and lots of people. That's why we go on television. We make films as well.
On Broadway, a critic can really kill a play overnight.
Not a critic. One critic can kill a play.
critic for the New York Times, you mean?
That's correct. The New York Times has the greatest readership for people who go to the theater. And actually, they're influenced by the first string critic, which would be Frank Rich in this particular case, who has a tremendous power, not personally, but the fact that he's backed by this paper that has this kind of readership.
Is it that way off Broadway?
It's the same. I mean, it isn't very much different. A small company, you know, tries to survive on its own, but if they get a bad review, the chances are nobody will come. People, you know, they leave their houses and they have other alternative forms of entertainment, and so they're very selective.
You have a reputation for actually picking up the phone, calling a critic, and bawling him or her out for a bad review that you thought was unjustified. Is that just reputation, or is that really true?
No, I've done that, and we'll continue to do that from time to time. I feel they're stupid, and sometimes they are utterly dumb. I find Frank Rich sometimes, because he's no fool, but sometimes I totally disagree with his point of view. Other times I feel he's right. Sometimes he's criticized some of the things we've done, but I don't learn anything from him or from anybody, from any critic. They don't teach me anything. All I want is a good review. I want people to come to see the plays I do.
Isn't it impolitic to bawl out a theater critic?
Yes, it is impolitic. I've thrown theater critics out of the theater. That's more impolitic. I threw Walter Kerr out of my theater.
What did you tell him?
Told him to get the hell out. I used a fancier word than that. And because he had no right to be there. It was a preview, and he had no right. We weren't ready to invite critics. And the same thing with John Simon. I just got him by the tie one night and just sort of pushed him around a little bit because I felt the way he mistreated people was terrible. I mean, the way he said about actors, that's cruel, that kind of stuff. I mean, critics have the right to criticize. They can say anything they like. But when they start to become personal about actors' appearances or they become snide and all that stuff, well, then I don't need them. They can get the hell out.
I would think that you would just engender more antagonism by taking that attitude toward critics and throwing them out.
That's true, but a lot of them are gone. I'm still there. So it's true, it does do that, but also you get angry because you want to support the writer. The writer gets hurt the way they treat him, you know, or her. I mean, they work several years on a play and someone discredits it. There's some lousy plays, and I know when they're bad. And when they're bad and they don't turn out too well, I have no argument with a critic. But I also know when they're good. I mean, I've been around longer than most of them. I know more about the theater than they do. And so when they're particularly cruel, I do that. I don't do too much of it now. It's just really a waste of time because you'll never educate a critic. I mean, they are what they are.
One of the things you've really done is find Black, Hispanic, and women playwrights whose work wasn't getting performed to a large public. It seems to me you've probably had to travel to really small theaters and performance spaces and out-of-the-way places to discover people. How do you do it? Do you have a routine for doing that?
No, it's not a routine exactly. Once you begin to operate in the proper way, you begin to generate a particular kind of work. You begin to attract people. I mean, Black writers who thought they would never could be produced would come to me because they know that they have a chance. Black actors, Hispanic actors, they know we're not going to, you know, twit them around and pretend and cast in any kind of, symbolic manner that we give parts to good actors. And this summer you'll see in the park, you'll see, you know, multiracial company. And I don't do it because, you know, because I'm a liberal, because I'm not. I do it because I think it's the right thing and get the best actors. And I think New York is a multiracial community and should be represented on the stage that way.
What did you mean by this, I'm not a liberal?
Well, I don't like the word liberal to me has certain connotations, which I don't identify with. I feel I'm more radical than I am liberal. I believe in liberalism. I mean, believe in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. But I take stronger stands on things than just talking about it a lot, right? So, and I do them. Just don't. It's not a theory to me. The Constitution is not a theory to me, nor the Bill of Rights, or the theater itself, and what it's supposed to do in a society. It has to have impact and meaning. It has to deal with social issues. And the people themselves that are in it have to be part of this. The fabric of a theater has to represent the entire fabric of our society. And if you're going to go into the schools where you have Black and Hispanic and Asian students, you're not going to bring in an all-white company and insult these people. And so that takes doing. And you have to train people. You work with people. It's not easy. There are some Black actors that are just extraordinary and as good as any white actor. A lot of Black actors and Hispanic actors haven't had an opportunity to be in theater and to work, and you have to spend a lot more time working with some of these people. The same is true in the general situation. People who have not been in the picture, not because of themselves, but because of the way things work out, you have to make an extra effort in those areas, and we make that effort because it's my responsibility, I feel, and I assume that responsibility.
Joe Papp, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Joe Papp, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Theater producer and director Joe Papp is my guest. He's the founder and director of the New York Shakespeare Festival, which is the country's largest theatrical operation. I've seen some really wonderful theater. I mean, theater that I would have really gone out of my way to see if I had to. Some of it I did go out of my way to see. But I've also seen a lot of really bad theater. And probably the bad numerically outweighs the good. And what keeps me going back is that the good theater makes it all worthwhile. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I wonder how you feel as a producer about that, because I don't know if it all feels as consistently terrific.
Never. Mm-hmm. It feels consistently terrible. It's unusual that you feel terrific. The problem is that the theater, which at one time was the dominant form of entertainment in this country, is now not the dominant form of entertainment by any means. You have television and films primarily, and you have records, and you have rock concerts, you have this. So the theater is historically a little antiquated. And so here and there, there are efforts being made to keep it alive. Broadway today, for example, is kept alive only through British imports at this point. We're like it's like Japan. We're keeping our car industry going by importing Japanese cars. And it's hard to, as Americans, to really accept this notion, but it's true. We're not a first-rate power in certain areas. We're certainly not in the theater anymore. And consequently, the thing I've been involved with now and have been for over the years, and particularly this coming years, is to begin to, in going against history and going against the tide, to try to make theater important. Now, how do you do that? Well, last year, maybe it's not even a year, it's just maybe several months, we did a play by a new writer, Puerto Rican writer, Ray Pavard, a play called Cuba and His Teddy Bear. But who did I have in that play? I had Robert De Niro in the play. Robert De Niro, who hadn't been on the stage for 12 years. I also had Ralph Macchio, the Karate Kid, in the play, who had never been on the stage before. Worked with this particular play, a new playwright, never been produced before. Opened it off Broadway, got a lot of people coming in, decided to take it to Broadway. Took it to Broadway, only for 10 weeks, played to 100% capacity, filled every seat in the house night after night. Low cost seats in the balcony. I thought maybe we'd break even. We made several hundred thousand dollars on the thing, and we brought people into the theater who had never been in the theater before. I can tell that. So the principle that I'm operating on, and this is true for the classics as well, which I'll be doing next season, is to begin to make our contacts with the major actors in this country, get them to commit themselves, which I'm doing. I have some of the best. Even Michael J. Fox came to see me the other day, day before yesterday, interesting actor, serious actor, saying to these people, you want to be an actor? Or do you want to continue doing just one film after another and never really establishing yourself as a major actor? If you really care about the art of acting, it has to be on the stage and it has to be with great roles. You have to play the major parts in great classics. There's no way to become a great actor without a great play.
Is this going to undermine your commitment to finding new actors?
No. In fact, this is only for certain leading roles. Mm-hmm. The main company, the company of young actors who will be playing understudying, playing small parts, will have even a company of their own. So that there'll be people who are just graduating from Juilliard now. There's some very good people coming out from NYU and so forth in New York.
You know, it seems to me the weak link in the theater is playwrights. Because I think there's some terrific actors. Even in bad productions, I see some terrific acting and directing, and it's frequently the plays themselves that don't seem very
good. If you
get
a good audience, you'll get good playwrights. You start getting audiences coming out to the theater, being attracted by actors that they come out for. People come out to see performers. You're intellectual. Don't be so intellectual. Because if you go with the rest of the crowd, people want to see this person or that person in playing a role. And that's why people go to the theater. They used to go to the theater for that reason. They go to see people of great reputation. Now, the people I will involve in these things are not anybody. There'll be people who can act, and they have to be able to do the job. Otherwise, they'll make fools of themselves and me. If Meryl Streep comes back and plays a role, she's a first-class stage actress. And Robert De Niro is a fantastic stage actor, actually. He showed tremendous. He can play King Lear. And aside from the obvious people, Kevin Kline, he played Hamlet last year. Now, he's part of this whole movement. And that will start to bring people in the theater, and I think with worthy players. At the same time, new writers will be excited by the fact that there's theater going on and that their play is a classic that they should be seeing. Because a lot of new writers have no sense of form and structure. They should be able to go to the theater and see some of the great playwrights. They don't see enough of that, too. But there are a lot of talented writers around, lots of talented writers. They need an audience. They need some kind of support over a period of time. We spent 5, 6, 7 years. This play, Kubin is Teddy Bear, took 6 years to work with this young writer who was 18 when he started. So that all that has to be decided to be done and requires some kind of support. In other words, the government has to show some interest in this and consider it important.
You've discovered and helped nurture the careers of a lot of now well-known actors.
Absolutely, and we'll continue to do that.
Yeah, do you usually see something right away in them? You know,
yeah,
you
certainly
see
something
right away.
That's why you're spending time with these people. Otherwise, you wouldn't cast them if you didn't see something right away. Otherwise, you wouldn't be working with this writer unless you saw something right away. You can tell quite clearly from the very beginning if someone is talented. Some people manage to continue to write, and some, if talking about writers, for example, some don't. I mean, some people win the Pulitzer Prize and then they never write another play. We've had two of those people. We had Charles Gaudin, Chuck Gaudin, wrote a play, a beautiful play, marvelous writer, No Place to Be Somebody, the first black writer to win a Pulitzer. And then we had Jason Miller, Jack Miller, who wrote that championship season, hasn't written a play. But I knew they were both talented writers and also actors. You can see in 5 seconds a talented actor.
You know, it's interesting to me. I know you're getting an honorary degree today from the Philadelphia College of
Art.
Well,
the reason I'm coming to this is that they are... This college is establishing. They have a marvelous theater department, and they're giving degrees in theater for the first time, I hear.
But you, I understand, didn't go to college. You have a million honorary degrees, but
I never went to college. No, I had to go to work right after high school.
Now, some people who didn't go to college work so hard at overcompensating that they have this like intellectual patina, so that they seem really smart, so that no one ever says, "Well, you didn't go to college."
Well, nobody's ever said to me, you didn't go to college. It wouldn't make any difference if they said that to me. Why would they say that to me? But I don't think I was fine to overcome anything because I didn't go to college. I don't think so. I was always involved because I enjoyed this work a lot, and I love Shakespeare. I just love his work. I'm telling you, I'm reading his stuff again and again. And you think by now I would be tired of it, right? I'm directing Richard II this year, which is a play all in verse and rhymed couplets. A great play with Peter McNichol playing the lead. And I'm also doing Henry IV, Part 1, which is the sequel to that play. They're two gorgeous plays for different reasons. Why do I get excited about a play all over again? You'd think by this time you wouldn't be talking about it. You'd say, well, you know, you get a little, you know, you've been around a while, and you become kind of cynical about things. Not at all. And the certain actors that I'm talking to now, like Kevin Kline, we spend hours talking about acting. And you'd say, well, why is he? He's a successful actor. Why are these people talking about acting? Al Pacino, we talk about acting all the time. We talk about this profession as though it's were a live thing, as though it had to do with contemporary medicine. It has the same meaning for us and hundreds of other people.
You're going to hate this. This is really a cynical thing to say. But for some actors who have really big box office, I get the feeling sometimes they want to do theater almost as penance for some of the films that they've done and to prove that they can be very serious.
I don't hate what you just said. That may be a factor. I don't know if it is or not. I haven't seen very many people pay any penance. Al Pacino, for example, always loved to come back to the stage. I don't think it had to do with penance. I know him personally, and I wouldn't say that. Kevin Kline just loves the theater. He just loves the theater more than he doesn't feel that acting in a film is acting. So I don't see very much of that. Yeah, I don't think it's accurate. If I saw it, I would certainly have no hesitation to say so.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Do you have theater nightmares?
And what sort you mean?
Dreams, literally dreams.
I dream about the theater?
Yeah.
Well, all dreams are theater. Because you, in a dream, you're both the actor, the director, and you're also the scenery.
But you don't roll the credits at the end.
Sometimes you do, or the discredits at the end.
But do you have the equivalent of dreams where you walk out of stage
when I'm working on a play? Oh, wow. Well, you know, the worst dream you have, whether you're an actor or a director or anything, is that you come on and you don't know the lines. In fact, you don't know what play you're on. And you're on the stage and there are thousands of people out there and you say, well, what is the first line? If music be the food of love, play on. That's the first line. What's the first line of Hamlet? Do you know that?
No.
Who's there is the first line of Hamlet. Anyway, that's a funny way to start a play. You wouldn't think a great play like that would start with that. Who's there? But the kind of dreams you have, I think I have personal dreams, and I guess theater life gets mixed in with it sometime. Because I'm so immersed in the theater. I mean, I live the theater 7 days a week.
You direct and you produce. Did you ever really want to act?
I've acted. I was in Death of a Salesman on the Road Company.
But you didn't stay with it.
No, it's too hard to act. It's the most difficult of all the professions because you have to be extremely vulnerable. You have to give yourself to the thing completely. I like to perform occasionally, and I do. I've been offered a lot of films, and I just don't do them because they're boring kind of things. But I enjoy performing. But to make a career of it, which means suddenly you're in the worst thing is to be in a hit show where you have to do 8 performances a week. That's very tiresome. I don't know how some actors do it.
Well, you direct them.
I know. But I go through the process and help me create the role, and then I don't have to be there every night as they do. It's a whole different thing. We say goodbye to each other for a little while, and they're sort of on their own then, you see.
Joe Papp, I've really enjoyed meeting you, and I want to thank you very much for speaking with us
today.
Enjoy
talking to you. Don't be afraid to say bad things. It's not so bad at all.
Okay. I've been speaking with Joe Papp, who's probably the most influential theater producer in America. He's the founder and director of the New York Shakespeare Festival. This is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with ABC White House correspondent Sam Donaldson. So I hope you can join us. Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional funds from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, baseball writer Bill James talks about finding beauty in the box scores. Also, accordionist William Schimmel demonstrates the little-appreciated versatility of his musical instrument. Critic-at-large Laurie Stone examines two books that explore the relationship between mothers and daughters. And we'll get the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. One of the musicians at the forefront of the tango revival is also trying to revive interest in his instrument, the accordion. That's the group The Tango Project. Accordionist William Schimmel is one of the co-founders of the group. His mission is to regain respect for an instrument usually associated with the Schmenge brothers and schmaltzy renditions of Lady of Spain. We invited William Schimmel to bring his accordion to our studios. He strapped it on and began to play, but he paused for a moment to tell us that his instrument always seems to have a mind of its own.
Whenever I play something on the accordion, no matter what it is, the accordion always wants to change it for me. So even if I'm playing Bach, a Bach prelude or a Bach fugue, all of a sudden the accordion may want to go into salsa or some Latin rhythm. And all of a sudden, I have a whole new piece. Bachianus Argentinus, we could call it, actually. Or if I'm playing Beethoven, a malanga may emerge, which is a kind of a little bit of a tango. Recomposing pieces isn't really anything new. We know that Liszt did it back in the 19th century, and Busoni did it. And they called their works fantasies, especially their keyboard works. And I like to call my works realities. Because when you play these things on the accordion, even if you know the tune or know the melody, or you think you know it, what happens, the accordion translated into a direct experience. It is so gut level, it is so emotional, that the only thing you can call it is reality. It is so direct. And as a matter of fact, you know, even Kurt Weill, speaking of really gut level and direct, even Kurt Weill rewrote some of the songs of Bertolt Brecht and redid them. As a matter of fact, Mack the Knife is one of them, and he orchestrated it and did a lot of elaborations on it. Now, let's say if I took Kurt Weill's favorite rhythm, the tango, one of mine as well, and I added the Grieg Piano Concerto, and I added the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto, and the Warsaw Concerto, or our favorite 19th century war horses, let's see what we come up with, or let's see what the accordion would come up with. That's musical reality. Have a good day. This is William Schimmel.
Accordionist William Schimmel is a co-founder of the Tango Project. Recently, he co-created and performed in The Road to Patagonia, a two-person show in New York tracing the evolution of the accordion in vaudeville. You're listening to Fresh Air. The 1987 baseball season has been underway for about 5 weeks now, and that's already long enough to create a small mountain of data for baseball analyst Bill James. James sifts through baseball statistics, often creating his own formulas to use in place of traditional measures like batting average and runs batted in. He publishes his findings and his personal observations in his annual book, The Bill James Baseball Abstract. James has been called obsessed with statistics, but he told me that they're just a tool he uses to better understand the game.
Baseball people have all these things that they say approximately 9 million times a year. Players' peak is from 28 to 32. The players today don't spend as long in the minor leagues as they used to. All these things they say over and over and over again without ever stopping to check them out. So it's my particular niche in life to stop and check them out.
So most of the time, do the statistics you come up with support the general wisdom of the day?
Sometimes they do. The general rule is that the wisdom of the day is always overstated. Whatever it is that people think they know, it always turns out to be a little less emphatically true. A lot of them are just plain nonsense.
What's a general accepted piece of accepted wisdom that you've proved to be nonsense?
Well, in this year's book, I took up the statement that the players of today lack the refined skills because they don't spend as long in the minor leagues. And I looked at how long they spend in the minor leagues today as opposed to 1980 and 1970 and 1960 and 1940, and I found that they spend just as long in the minor leagues as they ever did. The average number of games played in the minor leagues before a player reaches the majors was about 450 in 1940, and it's about 450 now. It really hasn't changed over time. So what it is as you get older, the perception of time changes, and that causes people to think something has changed when it really hasn't.
Why do statistics work so well in baseball better than they do in other sports? People aren't as interested in statistics in basketball and football as they are in baseball.
Because the game is so orderly. It's the only game in which the players take turns. It's the only game in which the players stop. The action stops at particular points marked off at the field. The player goes to first base or second base. He doesn't stop 40 feet beyond first base because that's as far as he can get, like he would in football. The game is so orderly that it's easy to make a record of, and that makes record keeping and statistics easy.
You seem to see a certain poetry in the statistics of baseball.
Quite certainly, yes. People think that I'm just saying this, but it's really true that the way in which baseball statistics are understood is as a type of language, that when a hitter hits 300, you don't think about 30% or 30.0%. What you think, I mean, the word 300 means something. The word 40 in the home run column means power. The word or the number 50 in the stolen base column means speed and a particular degree of speed. It doesn't mean 50 of something. Nobody, if you see 50 in the stolen base column, you don't think about 50 eggs or 50 baskets of cauliflower or 50 anything else. It just means speed. So the way in which people interpret stats is as baseball stats is as a kind of language, and they're very capable of literature and very capable of poetry.
your interest in history and in statistics have led you to write about players who are actually pretty obscure. You've been writing about players who many people have never heard of.
Yeah, well, baseball history, as it is written by a lot of people, tends to focus a great deal on Joe DiMaggio and Willie Mays. And I think it's equally fun to focus on Jumbo Brown and Garland Bruxton and people of that nature, yeah.
Who are these guys and why are they interesting?
Jumbo Brown was interesting because he was the biggest man ever. I think his official weight was something like 290. It was like 6'2 and 290, which made him the heaviest player ever to play Major League Baseball.
It is pretty heavy for a baseball player, for any right. athlete, yeah. When did you start keeping track of baseball statistics?
When I was 11 years old in 1960.
And when did you start keeping up with baseball?
About the same time, 1960 and 1959.
Did you think that when you got older that your interest in baseball wouldn't be so great anymore? Because I think that's what a lot of people expect. You know, then you kind of you grow up and then you become interested in another field and you settle in and so on. Watch a game on Sunday.
I suppose that happens to a lot of people, but there are an awful lot of real hardcore baseball fanatics in the country, which is why I make a living.
I can't help but think that you are finding some larger truth in the game of baseball.
Well, baseball reflects a larger truth, yes. Baseball is essentially nothing, and thus anything that happens in life can be seen more clearly in baseball and can be accepted more clearly in baseball, which is why it is so important to society. Baseball is always expected to clean up its act before anything else is. Racism, which is tolerated in society, is not tolerated in baseball. Drug use, which is tolerated in society, is not tolerated in baseball, because baseball is nothing, and therefore your view of it is so much clearer. That is your view of life, which is complicated with everything. Does that make any sense?
Well, I think so, but I've always thought that's one of the reasons why we don't want baseball players to be on drugs or whatever, is because they're always held up as national heroes and symbols of what it means to be American.
That's right. They are heroes.
Uh-huh.
Athletes are heroes. That's why they get paid $1 million a year. That's exactly what they are.
Are they heroes to you? You're looking at the game from a different perspective than hero worshippers do, and I'm trying to figure out what kind of relationship you actually have with the athletes.
Well, I have almost no relationship with the athletes. It's not my job. But the study of heroes is not hero worship. I mean, one can write about heroes without worshipping them.
Your work is so highly esteemed, though, that I understand that a lot of players are asking you to consult with them when their contracts come up. I wonder if you ever have any ethical questions about that, about using all the information that you've compiled as a kind of observer and using that to help make a case for someone, getting a higher salary.
Yeah, it does create potential problems, yes. I have no problem at all with baseball players getting higher salaries. The New York Yankees this year will generate income of, $40 to $50 million in all likelihood. No one has ever been able to give me a reason why George Steinbrenner should just be allowed to keep all the money. I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all to me. I think the players should get the money or get a fair share of it, and I have no problem with that at all. There are, however, potential problems with both writing about someone and helping to represent them in salary negotiations.
What problems does it create for you?
My reviews of players in the abstract are not always kind. And I realized 2 years ago that the players I had been the hardest on were those players that I was, whose agents were friends of mine and people that I worked with, and thus people that I potentially helped to represent. There's a shortstop in Oakland named Alfredo Griffin, who is the favorite client of the Hendricks brothers, whom I worked with for years. My reviews of Alfredo were just tremendously harsh. The same is true of Enes Cabell, who was represented by the Rich Group, who I also represent. All of the players that I had been really hard on were players that I potentially helped to represent, and I realized that probably on some level, without being aware of it, I was compensating. I was making sure that I wasn't favoring these players by being perhaps harsher than was necessary.
When you watch a baseball game, what do you do? Are you taking notes as the game proceeds?
I have several different modes in which to watch a game. I used to scribble notes furiously, but since I have a baby daughter, I generally am keeping one eye on the daughter and one eye on the baseball game. So I shift to a more casual mode, I suppose.
Have you ever gotten into arguments with any of your fellow baseball fans who all resent the emphasis on an empirical analysis of the game, on the game broken down into numbers?
Arguing about baseball is what I do for a living. So in a sense, yes. I don't know. A lot of people are interested in following baseball. Baseball is something which exists to be enjoyed. And it can, whatever your particular bent is, can be adapted to baseball. If what you're interested in is drinking beer, you can go to a baseball game and drink beer and soak in the game and enjoy it on that level. If what you're interested in is cute guys, then there are women who go to baseball game because they think the guys are cute. Baseball is essentially nothing, and for that reason, anything can be adapted to it. If, however, the approach is that you can't possibly learn anything by the numbers, then I just ignore it. I just don't respond to that, because anyone who takes that approach is an idiot, and I'm not going to argue with idiots.
Strong words from Bill James, the author of the Bill James Baseball Abstract and the Great American Baseball Stat Book. He spoke with us from member station KQED in San Francisco. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
Well, we're going to catch up on the week's events at the Iran-Contra hearings, talking with Linda Wertheimer and Cokie Roberts, who have been covering those hearings very closely.
I understand the real hot news is the temperature in your studios.
Yes. Our air conditioning broke yesterday. It has been oppressively hot here in Washington indoors, although outdoors it's quite nice. And we're going to try to get through tonight's program with dry ice in the studio. Speaking of steamy stories, also we'll be hearing from Leonard Bernstein's newest biographer, Joan Pizer, and also about why the operators of government nuclear plants don't want to accept liabilities for accidents.
Okay, thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today, our critic at large, Laurie Stone, looks at two new novels about mother-daughter relationships. Laurie says the authors, Mona Simpson and Vivian Gornick, take a timely and honest approach to the subject.
I just read two marvelous, unsentimental books about mothers and daughters, and they got me thinking about how rare this depiction is. One is a novel, Mona Simpson's Anywhere But Here. The other, Fierce Attachments, is Vivian Gornick's memoir of her Bronx youth. In most of what we read and see, mother-daughter relationships are distorted. We're not given a chance to see the central place this connection occupies in women's lives. And in movies and on TV, the relationships are generally too benign. One of the biggest fibs on daytime soaps is that the moms are always so chirpy and supportive of their girls. By the way, I have to admit, it's one of the reasons I love soaps. But true-to-life obsessiveness does crop up from time to time. It's all over the film Terms of Endearment and the public feud now raging between Betty Davis and her daughter. The players in these dramas, however, have little insight into what drives them. They're just in the grip. Simpson and Gornick, on the other hand, who've had the benefits of psychoanalysis and 20 years of feminism, are able to portray mother-daughter passions without apology or vengeance. And this mastery of the subject puts it in a new light. Adele, the mother in Anywhere But Here, is 32 when we meet her. She's uncertain and ambitious, fragile and overbearing, a woman without boundaries. She even cajoles Anne, her 10-year-old daughter, to skip out nude in front of friends. Anne, who tells the story, stays on guard, making herself precocious. Her awareness feels like a defect, bad breath, or worse, a missing faculty for love or trust. She counts the days until she can grow up. In the meantime, she helps her mother, frustrates her, and takes on her ways, the only ways she knows. What gives this book its heightened, almost surreal intensity is that Simpson trains all her fine intelligence on ordinary anguish. She's fearless, completely candid. Reading Anywhere But Here is like learning a secret from a relative that unlocks the mysteries not only of one's own family, but family life. In Fierce Attachments, Vivian Gornick also levels her sights at a mother who awes and ensnares her. She remembers a knot of women in the Bronx calling to each other across the back alley as they reel and wash, organizing tenants and carrying on as communist fellow travelers, smirking knowingly about sex desired and sex coerced. Gornick's mother fancies herself more developed than the others and the possessor of that rarest of commodities, a perfect marriage. It didn't include much sex, however, Gornick lets us know. Papa's love, she confides, did indeed have wondrous properties. It not only compensated for Mama's boredom and anxiety, it was the cause of her boredom and anxiety. The author's goal is to leave ghetto life. By the end of her book, she's made it clear that the ghetto isn't so much a physical place, but one of false sentiment. She arrives at the larger world of unflinching scrutiny and dutifully, adoringly, schleps her mother along. Simpson and Gornick are not protecting mothers from public view, but in telling the truth, neither do they lay out corpses. Every detail supplied by Gornick and by Simpson's narrator, Anne, makes the mother figures realer, less prey to simplifications, and the younger women's dried-eyed clarity saves them from their mother's self-dramatization, that endless casting of themselves as the ones acted upon and never in control of their fates. In Anywhere But Here and in Fierce Attachments, the truth told is something everyone has known, but few before have dared spit out so artfully and so boldly.
Lori Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's what's coming up next time. On our next show, I'll speak with South African writer Nadine Gordimer. Her latest novel, A Sport of Nature, looks at the uncertain role of whites in the liberation of her country's black majority. Jazz critic Francis Davis reviews a new album by composer and saxophonist Henry Threadgill. And TV critic David Bianculli looks at the new NBC series Molly Dowd. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM.
Fresh Air is produced at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name is Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.